Hello and welcome to AFPT Comics Podcast, episode 62. My name is David Brooke. I am your co-host. That means there are two hosts, and the other host with the most is...
Hello, my name is Forrest with two R's, and I am excited to talk about comics and maybe a couple other things, because I have a little a brainstorming session for you, a little icebreaker for you, David.
All right,
and
cool.
Do this at home, too. Tweet it at me, F-O-R-R-E-S-T underscore T-X-T on Twitter. What is your immediate reaction to the idea of Wendy's serving breakfast?
Yes, please.
Really?
I'm actually a Wendy's guy, so...
I like Wendy's, sure.
It's a trick. I always liked their chili, even when they had a finger pop up in one of them.
I like how you made that sound like it was one global event. A finger popped up in all chili. It was a weird marketing snafu.
Yeah, it was some demon made a bet with someone. And,
right. Mm-hmm. They accidentally
breakfast,
hired
huh?
a demon into their...
I'm actually surprised they didn't already do breakfast. I don't really go to Wendy's,
it's in
but...
Vogue. I don't know. It's in Vogue. I went and picked up some spicy nugs with my wife before recording this. I got a strawberry lemonade right here. I'm going to do some Foley work.
And whoa, is that ice?
It's ice. That's right. Need my strawberry lemonade cold.
Dun, 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 dun.
Their marketing campaign is pretty good. It's you up for this?
Whoa, I
it's
am.
It's Wendy's breakfast. And I don't even know what that means. If it means like an egg on a burger or if they're going to go like full McDonald's like burritos.
Ooh, I'd do that.
Have you ever had the Taco Bell breakfast?
No, I don't really have a Taco Bell near me.
That's strange.
Is it good?
No.
I live in a weird place where there are only Wendy's. Actually, I don't even know if there's a Wendy's near me. I don't go to fast food, really.
There's a Wendy's inside of a Wendy's.
Yes, a Russian doll Wendy's.
Mm-hmm. Anyways, if our fans, our friends, our listeners, our comics readers want to let me know what they think about Wendy's breakfast, that's where my head's at this week.
I think that you owe it to us and to me and the fans
to be a human experiment.
To read comics while eating a Wendy's breakfast inside a Wendy's. And then I need a selfie of that by Sunday, please.
I thought you wanted me to go eat some Wendy's breakfast and record like a field recording. We're going to have an episode 62B.
Yes, well, you record your side in Wendy's.
5 minutes on Wendy's breakfast.
Well, you know, I really am excited about that Wendy's news, but I'm also excited about
I was
going to
say, do you like
week?
How I buried the lead on our big news?
This is a show where we talk about comic books, of course. We review comic books. We have guests on to talk about their comic books. We also talk about the news. And the top of the news this week actually involves Forrest and I.
Yes.
I don't know if you guys know, but I think it's April 14th, Empire Number One comes out, kicking off Marvel's big summer event. It's going to last something like 12 to 14 weeks. Mm-hmm. And we got an inside track to a bunch of creators behind the series.
Editors, creators, yeah. Writers and artists.
And all the tie-ins. We're kicking off a new column called Empire State of Mind, Mind with a Y.
We're on brand.
We are. And this week, we actually petitioned, because this will be, a lot of the questions will be asked by Twitter folks.
Mm-hmm. Yep, or fans of the site.
Yep. And on our Twitter account, we put out a call to ask questions of Tom Brevoort, who will be, he's like the head editor of the event, actually.
Yes, yeah. Longtime editor at Marvel.
Oh, yeah. He edits a lot of like the main titles, like Avengers and stuff like that,
right,
too.
Yep.
So that's really cool. And we're really excited to be, you know, giving y'all this cool new content. It's sort of in the same vein as X-Men Monday.
Yes, but on Tuesday.
Yes, it's going to be going out Tuesdays. And there'll be some exclusive art in there, exclusive cover art that you haven't seen yet until you read this column.
Mm-hmm.
Since we will be doing Empire State of Mind, we will be rescinding our reviews of Empire.
Yes, I will not be. I mean, you know, if I read it and it shows up in my top books of the week, I'm not going to be sour about that. I'll plug it. But yeah, no written reviews for the series. No.
We want to keep the ethics on the down low. No, on the up low. On the up high? I don't know.
On the upgrade.
Anyway, we're really excited about this. It's pretty cool for the podcast, too, because, you know, it just gives us more stuff to talk about.
Yep. Every week, we're going to have an inside look at what building a huge event out like this for Marvel looks like. from an editor perspective, an artist perspective, I think ourselves as media perspective, and then hopefully, again, every week on Twitter, asking you guys to ask us questions or to ask the editors and artists questions, a fan perspective as well. So yep. I think it'll be a big communal thing, and I'm excited for all of us to go on this journey.
Yeah, if you go to our Twitter every Wednesday and Tuesday, I would say, we'll be putting out a call for new questions for different people every week. So check that out. So in our next bit of news, we sort of almost touched on this last week when we were talking about the coronavirus.
We talked around it. It's gotten a lot bigger since then, yeah?
Yeah, just in 1 week, a lot has happened with folks dropping out of ECCC.
Yes.
Emerald City Comic-Con.
Yes. My local con, a con which I was going to attend and report on for AIPT, maybe snag some interviews written or for the podcast. I will not be attending. And that's because of concerns around COVID-19, the coronavirus. I think people are they have an abundance of caution, which isn't necessarily a bad thing to have. I don't want to cast any aspersions on the con as of today when we're recording, which is March 5th. They are still planning on holding the convention. Reed Pop is. They have issued refunds to artists recently, and then I also got a refund for my tickets. Not my press pass, of course, but my tickets that I bought for my wife. ECC actually has a tracker built on their website to track all the cancellations now, and it's enormous.
It's gotten bad.
It's like every single panel, all the creators, a couple of the celebrity guests, full refunds to attendees, table refunds for Artist Alley, Dark Horse Comics, Jen Bartel, Jim Zub, DC, Del Rey, Benjamin Percy, Frank Cho, tons and tons. Mike Mignola, Jim Lee, CGC, Figpins, Scotty Young, tons and tons of other people have pulled out. Publishers, retailers, and creators. So it's, again, to date, they say that they are in compliance with the county measures on travel, on holding major events, stuff like that. I believe them. I don't want to cast aspersions on ECC as an institution. Reed Pop also runs C2E2, and that seemed to go off without a hitch to date.
Yep.
And so I understand that some creators want to go. I understand that ECC, is that enough C's? Too many C's? Another C.
It's a lot of C's.
Couple C's. I understand that they also maybe have a bit of a sunken cost thing going on where they have a lot of money into it. It's incredibly expensive for indie creators, self-published creators, even big two creators to go to conventions, to table, to produce work, to sell. They're looking down the barrel of having less customers. That sucks. ECCC is looking down the table of, or looking down the barrel of, not having as many events to draw people in, losing money on tickets, vendors, sponsorships, all that kind of stuff. So it's a very, very difficult situation. It is perhaps an overreaction, I think, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of news coming out of Washington State, isn't there?
Yes.
With the coronavirus. So it's like, it's such bad timing
for
when this is dropping and how like a lot of the news of like deaths and schools being closed are coming out of your
Seattle
state.
Yeah. And so I mean I think that that's really what the linchpin is that Seattle has kind of become a de facto epicenter, you know, it's not an epidemic or anything like that, but
no.
The state is in a state of emergency. I work for a public university. We've done a lot of work on preparing faculty and students for like what to do if you can't attend the university. Like, if we have to close it, we instituted a travel ban, all that kind of stuff. And then the idea of having, I don't know, like 100,000 people in a shared space, flipping through comics, food, panels, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I understand the concerns that people have. I personally am incredibly bummed out because I missed it last year due to unexpected kidney surgery. I was super stoked to go this year. But I will be live tweeting FCCC, which is, of course, Forest City Comic Con from my apartment next
Do you have any guests coming?
My wife, my dogs, my cats.
Very nice. Very nice.
Maybe I'll ask
Do your cats do submissions? Can I get, like, do they do any, like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll put their paws in some paint, have them walk around. So
I wonder, it'll be interesting if Emerald City Comic Con comes out and says, you know, anything about the numbers as far as their sales or anything, because this would be an opportunity to potentially get, you know, the community and fans more invested to maybe come back next year if they're having a really hard time.
Yeah, that's true. ECCC, I'm not sure about the Emerald City. It's kind of a fan and vendor and publisher favorite con. Even when they extended it to 4 days, which is long for a con of its type. I saw a lot of vendors, I saw a lot of artists and stuff saying that this was their favorite convention and they're really bummed that they can't go. So I think that they'll bounce back fine. Mm-hmm. But this year it's obviously a hit. I almost wonder if the correct response is to postpone it. But I don't know what that looks like logistically.
Yeah, I have some insight into like renting spaces like this. Mm-hmm. And it costs a fortune.
Yeah.
And you also have to book it 6 months in advance.
Sure, sure.
And at that point, you're just calling it on the entire thing. But that's the other thing I was thinking about. Like, maybe they're not canceling because they would take a huge loss on the space.
Right, and I don't know what, like, if insurance has, you know, acts of God or anything like that. I know, I saw recently, actually, in the music industry that a bunch of, like, tour insurance and band insurance and stuff was like, hey, we're not covering COVID-19. So maybe capitalism sucks.
Yeah,
you know, maybe insurers are like, too bad, so sad.
Right, I don't know. Right. I wouldn't be surprised if they did.
I'm incredibly bummed. I was hoping to get some WWE commissions and also some Star Wars art commissions to put up on my wall. I'm looking at a wall of stuff I bought at ECCC 2 years ago. Incredibly bummed. Hopefully, there's this really neat project going on. I want to make sure that I get it right. I think it's bit.ly/ECCC creators, so 4 C's in a row, creators, and it's a whole list of all the people that have canceled, links to their websites, links to their social media and stuff. They're asking people to like still solicit commissions through them for digital or mail delivery, obviously. So I might do that because I had some money saved up for that, so we'll see.
That's cool. Yeah, it's a bummer. We're going to be tracking this, of course, because this is a weekly podcast, and we'll see if this affects any other conventions as we get further into the year. I don't think there's any really big conventions for a little while.
For a bit, and I'm curious to see how Emerald City goes off. I did see a couple of artists like, hey, I get a bunch of tables now. Cool. I'm going to spread out.
Yeah, Sabella. Is that the one you're thinking of?
I did see Sabella saying that,
That's funny.
I'm a big fan of him.
Well, yes, we will see if any news comes out, if news about the event itself, too, especially, I think. But we are just coming out of C2E2. Obviously, we talked about this a little bit last week, but there was some news that we didn't get to in our last week's show. The biggest news, of course, last week was Ten of Swords. I'm sorry. But one thing I wanted to bring up that Ari Bard, reporter for AIPTComics.com, he was there. He did a great job live tweeting a lot of the events. Panels. And he did a great write-up on the Jim Lee Spotlight. And, you know, Forrest, you and I have been talking a lot about Dan Didio, so this piqued my interest extra, extra. He had some comments on Didio's departure. He didn't really say anything official as far as why, but he did say there are rumors and speculation and that we shouldn't put any credence into them. Which, you know, you expect him to say stuff like that. But
what's weird is that his comments about that don't really seem like they're about Didio at all, which is obviously what people wanted to know. The full quote is to address some of the stuff that's out there. There's rumors and speculation. I wouldn't put any credence into it. DC has been around for 85 years. We'll be around for another 85 years. I hope to be doing this panel in 85 years. Unlikely. we've been with Warner Bros. For decades. The actual strategy is for DC to put publishing at the center of what they do. Which is a very nice way to not talk about Dan's departure at all. But I think to cast a little bit of blame on him, I don't want to extrapolate too much, but it's basically Jim saying, we're going to completely reshift our strategy.
You know, based on how he didn't, I mean, he's a businessman, of course.
Yeah.
But I always saw them as buddies. because they were co-publishing together. Yeah. And I don't know if he's just, you know, a shark in a sense that he's just going to move forward. And I mean, you know, you can't blame him. He's working for this billion-dollar company. But at the same time, I was a little surprised there wasn't any sentiment about, you know, Dan leaving or, you know, the work they did. He didn't talk about that at all.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, he could have at least said, like, some of the stories we put out the last 2 years, you know, were because of Dan and I having, you know, blah, 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 blah. But none of that kind of came out, mm-hmm. which was a little bit of a shock to me.
Warner Bros. And AT&T are big, powerful companies.
They have hitmen. Is that what you're saying?
It wasn't, but I guess they have corporate hitmen.
Right.
You know, like, you can really tarnish your career or, you know, a board of trustees doesn't like the way that you said something or sold something to someone and you're off the deep end. So
right. But basically he was saying they're going to continue on and have lighthearted and fun and inspiring stories, et cetera, et cetera. And but he also talked about Gambit.
He did. Yeah.
That was the thing I was most excited about. I'm not even going to talk about that though. If you go to aptcomics.com and read the article, he's got some interesting little tidbits about why Gambit is a Cajun.
Why Gambit was the question.
Yeah. In other C2E2 news, there was a Superheroes of DC panel that Ari also covered. Some interesting things said about your favorite upcoming event, Death Metal, by Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo.
I love it.
If you guys listen to the show, you know what I'm talking about. If you don't listen to the show, then you should go back and listen to the show. God, what's wrong with you? Anyway, it was pretty much the creators kind of pitching their stories. There's some interesting tidbits in there about Flash. Gail Simone was there as well. Daniel Warren Johnson was talking about Woman.
Yeah, I actually wanted
Dead
to
Earth.
Call that one out real quick. He said,
"Yeah."
Daniel Warren Johnson said that Wonder Woman Dead Earth was his only pitch for DC Black Label. He'd never been interested in Wonder Woman before and wanted to pitch a Wonder Woman story that he'd want to buy. Which, that's a little inside baseball on the fact that they are soliciting stories explicitly for Black Label. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not letting people create stories and then being like, oh, do you want to shift the content up and we'll make it Black Label? Or, hey, on an editorial pass, we'll let this play at Black Label. It sounds like they're seeking ways to build Black Label out for sustainability. Daniel Warren Johnson is a high-profile indie creator, too. Mm-hmm. So that's neat to be courted for that. It reminds me a little bit of the Vertigo approach. And I guess, again, want to echo, I don't understand why Vertigo had to go away for this to happen.
Motherfuckers.
but still cool. Still cool. Black Label's in a way better place than I would have ever expected.
Yeah, you know, I kind of parrot what you've said in previous shows. I think Death Metal should be Black Label.
I get, sure. It should this be. Is what Scott Snyder said. I don't even know. Like,
he said, Wonder Woman melting the invisible jet, Swamp Thing wearing sunglasses, Cthulhu Dark Knight, a Bruce Wayne AI Dark Knight, a sentient Gotham, a trapped Superman forced to power the sun. To sum it all up, it's the anti-crisis. And he said, it's taking bigger to its biggest.
Oh, I just love that. No.
Look, dude, it's like a monster truck rally.
That's
at
like
this point.
Really, yeah, I was going to say it's like really bad, like 2000s. Xbox, this video game will kill you.
Yes, it's like energy bad, drinks, like Monster dude. Energy drinks.
It's bad.
Just lean into it, dude. Just lean into it and be like, yes, wash over me. I want this way over the top thing.
So what? So Donny Cates can quote tweet me again and have nerds yell at me all day?
I mean, it's the one of the best ways to get new followers.
True.
Like, come on.
Yeah. Sorry, y'all.
Speaking of Donny Cates. Yeah, sorry.
Go ahead. I was going to say most people that responded to me that day were pretty cool, but there were some people that I was like,
that's good.
Whoa.
Yeah, when you're getting the toxic folks, it can be
lessons in missing the point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. One last C2E2 news. We talked a little bit about the Venom Free Comic Book Day pages that were reviewed.
Yeah, we got an early look at those. I was very excited by those Venom pages.
Yeah, they were pretty cool. And the yellow, you know, the character with the yellow painted symbol
on
the chest.
Yeah, the quasi war machine. Yeah.
He has a name.
Oh.
What's his name? What's my name?
What's his name?
His name is Virus.
Take a look real here. Virgil? No, it's Virus.
It starts with a V.
It's Virus.
And ends with an us.
He is not a symbiote. Ryan's
you plus me equals us.
Ryan Sigmund and Donnie were pretty quick to swat that down. I was surprised.
What's that?
Almost immediately, they were like, hey, virus is not a symbiote.
Oh, yeah, yeah, like, yeah.
Like, one, this isn't Sleeper, and two, this isn't a new symbiote either.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is because a fan said, another one, there's so many now, or something. And right, I think they were like, hey, nope.
I mean, you can kind of tell it's not a symbiote. It's made of, like, garbage.
It's, like, biomechanical. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So, it's cool. I like the idea of a, maybe, Punisher for symbiotes.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so do you think, I want to ask you a personal question.
Yeah.
Is there an editor in a room right now going, we planned this a month ago, but we called it virus months ago, but now there's an actual virus. Is this a good thing in the editor's mind or a bad thing?
Hey man, it's topical.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he is the villain. It's not it's not a good guy named coronavirus.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know.
It'll be interesting to see if that affects sales at all.
Yeah. I don't think so. I doubt they're going to put virus, the name on the cover or anything like that. I mean, Venom is the book that's selling.
Could you imagine if they had planned virus covers the whole month?
Oh, yeah.
That's crazy. That would be crazy. Yeah. It's probably not going to happen. They're not that stupid, are they?
Spidey office working overtime.
Speaking
right
of
now.
Stupid, in our next bit of news, Sean Gordon Murphy verse.
Thank you for that segue. I appreciate that.
Sean Gordon Murphy tweeted a few days ago now, I think, well, when you're listening to this about this week, he tweeted, so big news, DC wants a mini imprint of White Knight. I'll write the bones for new minis, and they'll set up the writer-artist team. It'll be done between new volumes of Batman White Knight. So essentially, DC wants to have this White Knight verse, Murphy-verse.
Murphy-verse.
He self-dubs that, by the way.
Yeah.
Sean Murphy says,
God,
it'll be the
so
Murphy-verse.
Fucking egomaniacal, dude.
He says, stay tuned for books on Harley, Nightwing, and Batgirl. So he's expanding his universe with more characters. And in between his story that he writes and draws with Matt Hollingsworth, your long-lost brother, coloring, they're going to be filling the gaps with creators. And he's writing the bones, which is fascinating to me that he comes right out and says, I'll be writing the bones. I feel like that's insulting to whoever ends up writing these mini-stories.
Yeah. But, I mean, some creators, if they're co-writers, maybe that's fine. I mean, Dan Slott alluded to as much with Christos Gage, so...
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. So, and then he came out with some rules. Four rules.
I'm so annoyed.
Dead characters stay dead. No inner monologues. Not a fan of using them. Stuff comes out on time, and only the best talent who puts customers, readers first.
Okay.
Forrest,
so,
are you excited for this?
No.
Okay.
Man, we got a review on iTunes once that was like, Forrest complains a lot, but he's pretty funny, so okay. I hate to have that reputation, but this fucking sucks, dude.
So, I don't know if our fans might not know,
so,
or listeners.
Yeah, so two things right off the bat that are bothering me. What is the point of DC marketing that there are going to be no other imprints if they're going to continue doing stuff like this?
Yes.
Like, Young Animal is basically an imprint unto itself.
Mm-hmm.
Black Label, Ink, Zoom, all these other things. I'm fine with that. Especially in the instance that it makes it more obvious to parents what books to buy for the YA books. Cool, whatever. But they structured it around an age bracket model that they clearly have no intention of actually following. Or no intention of actually following when something is a proven commercial and critical success. Then it gets to break all the rules, right? And I find that annoying. I was just talking up the way that they are structuring Black Label and that it finally feels sustainable. And then you're going to have this weird Murphyverse offshoot, and that doesn't make sense to me.
Well, it is still a Black Label book, technically, though.
I mean, White Knight is.
Yeah.
But I don't know what the future looks like.
Right. We have now a universe within the universe.
I mean, he's proposing an imprint, basically, or saying that an imprint is in the cards. The other thing is that, and for people that don't know, that there's a lot of information about this on various comics websites, on Twitter, creators feeds. Everyone was subtweeting Sean this week. Sean is covertly is much more blatant about it now, courting a certain group in the comics fandom. Comics Gate, Comics Gators, whatever they call themselves. He's allied himself with, you know, I think he said at some point in time that he didn't think anything that either Van Shriver was saying was too bad or detestable, or he should still have a job in comics or something along those lines. He was careful about it. He's also working on a Kickstarter campaign for Earthworm Jim comics, or comics by the creator of Earthworm Jim, Doug Ten Naple, who is a massive publicly outspoken homophobe and transphobe, to the degree that anyone working with him would have to be aware of that stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, it is his persona, Doug's persona. So Sean is active on Twitter, follows Doug, is working with him. You know, maybe he's one of those people that sees no congruence between work and personal political beliefs. But I personally think it's a really bad look. It's a really bad look when you're saying that you're going to respect your customers in particular. Because that makes it clear to me, I guess, that you mean a certain customer.
Mm-hmm.
And you definitely don't mean a diverse fan base. I'm very frustrated by it.
To me, a lot of what you just outlined,
mm-hmm.
to me, that should be a red flag for DC Comics. Because this kind of stuff eventually blows up in your face.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a big red flag to, I guess, Marvel, IDW, some other publishers. And then DC has this record of holding back on saying anything about Eric Esquivel, keeping Eddie Braganza in line for a long time. We're right. Still working with Scott Lobdell.
Right.
And I just don't think that that's their priority.
No, they're just, I mean, like any corporation, they're just going to wait for it to get real bad, then do something.
Sure. Sure. Yeah.
It's just, I mean, right now, Sean Murphy hasn't done anything detestable to the point where he needs to be fired on the spot, right? I mean, it's all
behind this
low-level stuff.
The thing that
exactly.
bothers me is it's always behind this veneer of, like, intellectualism, of, like, right. both sides-ism. But,
and then that's what my point is. Like, you have to see the tea leaves here. Eventually,
right.
it's going to
yeah.
bite you in the ass.
Or someone, you know, has established a pattern. And when you connect all those things, it's much more obvious what they actually believe and how they believe it's okay for other people, maybe not themselves, to treat fans.
And then you have shows like this where we're talking about it.
Yeah,
and it's
mean,
only increasing the notoriety
it
of it. That's
true. We're never going to platform him. I'm never going to have him on the show. I'm never going to interview him. But that I guess I do want to say that that's how these people operate.
Mm-hmm.
They get themselves to a level of notoriety, of fame, through good work. I mean, the Batman White Knight is basically, what if Batman was the cop that choked out Eric Garner? So it's kind yeah. of shitty and gross and weird anyway, even if it is a kind of interesting spin on, it's Occupy Gotham. But, and same with Curse of the White Knight, right? Like, I think it's artistically sound, narratively sound, whatever. And he's gotten to the point now where there's been so much commercial and critical success for his books that he's like, all right, now I can start saying what I really want.
Right.
And that's gross.
Right. You don't want to build a foundation of a universe on someone who could potentially, it could all go up in smoke.
Right. I mean, EVS was a fine artist, I guess. He was on New X-Men. He was on DC books and whatever. And then it was like, well the guy did just name his art book, it's a veiled reference to Hitler. That's kind of weird.
Kind of weird.
Kind of
yeah.
weird, right? And you're like, well, all right, well, it's a pun or whatever. And then he does it again. And right. you're like, okay.
Right.
The same kind of thing is happening with Sean.
And it's like you were pointing out, like I've pointed out, it makes you wonder what makes up DC.
And
you
what
know,
their
what's
priorities
their identity?
Are. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, one of the reasons why I was so psyched for, you know, DC Vertigo, or when they were rebooting Vertigo 2 years ago, was that there were a lot of, you know, diverse voices, a lot of different diverse stories coming out of that.
Yeah.
And now it seems like they've kind of abandoned that, maybe because they're aware that the Sean Murphys who are making Batman like a, you know.
Yeah. There's a really good Twitter thread out there from David Brothers, his at Hermanos on Twitter. Really good breakdown of what Comicsgate is, what the people behind it are, and how people like Sean Gordon Murphy see fans that are willing to write them blank checks for political posturing in their works or on Twitter or whatever.
You know what's interesting?
See them as marks, basically.
You see these comic skaters really cling to like Batman, and but they don't cling to Spider-Man.
Yeah, sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? Is it because Batman's like metal and dark?
Well, he's like a vigilante. I mean, I guess Spider-Man is too.
But he's not like breaking necks. Yeah,
we could get into the semantics of that, but I it probably
that could be a segment.
Just is that he's breaking necks, I guess.
In some positive news, Neil Gaiman will be narrating the new Sandman Audible series for Amazon.
I have a question for you, sir.
Uh-oh.
At what point are we going to call this prediction for me?
I forgot
about
that. Fucking
told you.
Well, I mean, he's a man who likes to narrate.
We
okay,
are
nothing new.
We are a month out from a new Sandman series. Are you fucking kidding me?
I mean, he'd be dumb not to do something with the comic, with the TV
yes.
show in development. And
yeah. So for folks that don't know, was it our year in review episode?
I think so.
We made predictions.
Yeah, we predictions.
We
yeah.
tried to make concrete predictions about the next year in comics. And mine was that Neil Gaiman is going to make a full-scale return to comics. So
yes. This is cool news. I mean, if you've ever listened to any of his books, he is an amazing narrator.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. This is cool news. I like that he's so committed to Sandman. I like that mm-hmm. the Sansverse, or whatever it's called, is like expanding with that new Waking Hours book, too. It's mm-hmm. not really the property that I ever expected to be this big and popular. Like, yeah, I know Sandman yeah. is popular, but it's always been popular. It's a kind of creator's book. Mm-hmm. Like, other writers and artists like it a lot, and Vertigo fans like it a lot, but I didn't expect it to have this kind of sustained mainstream success. Obviously, that comes coupled with Neil Gaiman's personal mainstream success.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. I like it.
This it should be noted that Dirk Maggs is writing the adaptation.
That's not a real name.
which Neil Gaiman goes on to say in this Newsarama article we're pulling from, almost 30 years ago, Dirk Maggs approached DC about adapting The Sandman into audio form. And he says, I'm glad it didn't because it's now a golden age of audio drama right now.
Mm, mm-hmm.
I think he's right. I feel like the golden age of audio books was like 10 years ago, but that's because maybe
I stopped listening
to audio books 10 years ago.
I was just going to say, this is super nerdy. The Warhammer 40K audiobooks are so cool.
Are those new?
They've been doing them for a while, but the newer ones, like the short stories ones and stuff I've been listening to, they're neat. They have like chainsaw sound effects and
nice.
Light sci-fi music and stuff. It's.
I was just thinking like Stephen King's been like, you know,
yeah.
he's got some of the best yeah. narrators doing his stuff. And then also, you know, the American Gods,
uh-huh.
another Gaiman
mm-hmm.
book. If you get that audio, I think there's two versions, actually. There's one with one person, and then there's one with an entire
yeah,
ensemble.
Yeah, the cast. There's one that was yeah. just one person that came in, like, 2006 or something. And then
back in the, you know, the dregs of the audio.
The Wild West days.
People would just walk up to mics and start talking.
Yeah. Recite American Gods from memory. Hey, everybody, this is my one-man play, Neil Gaiman's American Gods.
Yeah, I
can get down on some audiobooks. I think Audible's pretty neat, to be honest.
It is cool. Yeah, I like it.
Have you heard anything about the Stan Lee one? Is that still going?
Audiobook?
Yeah, he had like created a new universe called the Heroes Project or something.
I haven't heard
Audible
about that.
Audible was supposed to launch it. They were touting it around SDCC.
Mm-hmm.
And then I didn't really hear anything about it after that, so I was curious if it ever got off the ground. I guess maybe I'll follow up on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Next week on AIPT Comics Podcast.
Coming to you live from Wendy's Breakfast.
Episode 63, we're down in the Stan Lee dregs.
Episode 64, Upset Stomach.
In our next bit of news, Iron Cat, Iron Cat, where is
Look
Iron
out!
Cat? So I wanted to talk about this. It's not the biggest news to talk about necessarily, but it was fascinating to me how Marvel Comics was revealing the Iron Cat news.
Look out!
They were releasing tiny slivers, like I'm talking tiny images within an
image. 1/16th of an image.
they sent one to AIPT. I think they sent one to probably every, you know, website, comic book website. Newsarama ended up pulling a bunch of them together and forming this image, which is basically an Iron Man designed Black Cat costume.
Iron Cat.
That's about all the news we have on that, actually.
Yeah, interesting way to tease something. I was more into it than, say, like when they started teasing like Acts of Evil.
Right.
It's cool.
Right.
It's neat. I cannot believe, again, this is kind of how I feel about Black Label, too. Like, if you had told me Black Cat was going to be this big a deal, man, okay. Yeah. I like her.
Yeah.
It's cool. I'm glad it's popping off. They also seem to be queer coding her, so that's also cool.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I really like Jed McKay's first arc, mm-hmm. and he's got some good supporting burglars that she works with that are just regular people, which is kind of cool. Yeah. So, yeah, and obviously, we talked about this last week, but she's going to be in the Free Comic Book Day comic.
Right, yeah, and in Conan, and in all the events. But
is Marvel somehow
a
like...
a new imprint called Catsverse.
What if Tom Holland was like, get me Black Cat, I want her in the next Spider-Man movie.
All right, get me a Black Cat.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. Is that Cockney?
Sure. I don't know.
Okay, we have another piece of news here. It's our last piece of news. Former DC executive, creative director. That guy had a lot of words in his title.
It's such a weird title. I'm glad you thought that too.
Well, the former adds to it, but former DC executive creative director. I want to just keep going. I just want to make it a joke, but... he is named the Heavy Metal's new publisher and chief creative overlord, according to Newsarama.
Heavy Metal seems like a fun place to work, TBH.
I can only imagine, right? Yeah. It's this is interesting to me in part because there's so many folks getting publisher jobs right now at the same time as Dan Didio losing his job.
Oh, I don't want to conflate that stuff, but yeah.
Well, I mean, just mean like Mark Waid was hired. Yeah. Is this a time of year where you hire your publisher?
Well, there are a lot of sports... acquisitions and layoffs in the March to like May period, so maybe it has something to do with a financial schedule or calendar, quarterly reports and earnings and stuff.
You said sports, right?
Yes, yeah, it's a big thing.
So
in
like
the,
soccer,
like it's a big thing in the sports industries. Yeah, soccer, okay. Like basketball.
It's like a downtime.
I think so. Yeah, like I know. It even happens in like professional wrestling. So
right,
yeah.
We haven't even said his name yet. His name's David Irwin. Oh, what a great first
name
that is.
Originally, when I linked the article, we're using the Newsarama article for this as well. Those guys are on top of it, by the way. Great site. They didn't have the name of him in it. And I was like, oh, some guy's a new overlord. Cool. Spooky.
That's funny. Maybe human. Who knows?
He's committed to the bit. He changed his name to his title.
I am Overlord Executive Director and
right.
Publisher.
Usually only true for guys named Dean.
What? Is that a joke? I don't get it.
You could be a dean named Dean.
Why do you make me feel so dumb on the show? Dumb on the show. Dumb in the show. In our next segment.
Oh, keep going.
Give me a beat. In our next segment, we've been wanting to talk about this for a little
bit.
We keep getting sidetracked with interviews.
Really good interviews with Emily Horn and Zach Thompson about No One's Rose, their new Vault series. Last week's interview is exhausting. They're so smart and cool and nice.
I know. It's like, why do you want to be on our show? We just want to talk about Polygon articles. Could you imagine if this show was just like talking about Polygon articles?
Yeah, I could. Hey, did
you read that movie article last week? Yeah, on Polygon? So they had actually a really good article.
Yes.
Of course. Well, they have lots of very good articles. But a writer named Susanna Polo.
Yes, she's their comics editor. She's also she created the Mary Sue, the website. Fantastic journalist.
Right. Well, she got to interview top dogs in the comic book industry. Mm-hmm. And she put together this amazing article called The Biggest Name in Comics on What Defined the Last 20 Years and What's Next.
Yes.
So we've got folks like, Scott Snyder, C.B. Sobolski, Dan Didio, Jim Lee, Steve Orlando,
Gail Simone.
Yep.
Tom Brevoort, Scott McCloud.
Jeff Johns.
Yeah, there's a lot of folks in here.
Brian Hill.
I really liked the breakdown. So they broke it down decade by decade. Susanna broke it down decade by decade. starting with the 2000s, 2010s, and then the 2020s in the future. But I really wanted to talk about this thing that's in the side. First, the margin. It says, mm-hmm. Know your ages. The Golden Age, 1938 to 1956, the first boom and bust of superhero comics. The Silver Age, 1956 to 1970, the second boom of superhero comics. The Marvel Revolution, the first era in which kids who grew up on superhero books were old enough to write them. That's an interesting thing I'd never thought about before. The Bronze Age, 1970 to 1984, topicality and character depth. Superheroines, heroes of colors, the rise of soap opera books like the X-Men and Teen Titans, and the return of popular non-superhero monthly comics. And then the modern age, literally everything from 1984 on.
I don't know, that seems like a generalization.
Huge chunk. But I think that most comic scholars agree on that. And I
until we all die. I mean, and then
are we going to move into like the postmodern age? Because if you want to talk about the pillars of like postmodernism, mm-hmm. Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol is a postmodernist comic, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. so that era has kind of already passed too.
I feel like they just haven't figured out when to end this age, the modern age, and get to the next one.
Yeah, I mean, right? Most industries have kind of switched to like the digital age, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm wondering, like, people who are like in their, I don't know, teens right now, maybe they'll, by the time they're in their 30s, will figure out what the next age is. Because mm-hmm. it's always, you know, it's the old, always the younger generations that really kind of pin this down, right?
Sure. I think.
I don't know. It's a shock to me that the modern age is 84 till now, just because there are a lot of markers, I would say, over the last 30 years. You could say, oh, this is when that age ends.
Right. I mean, it's also the largest chunk by far. Most of them
which is another,
you know, 20 years, yeah. 10 years even. Yeah.
That's another marker of why I'm surprised there isn't another
marker. I thought so too. But it is interesting to kind of grapple with modernity in here as well. Were there any standout things to you? I was definitely September 11th, 2001, obviously, in the United States, an important date. Brian Hill had a really great comment about how that changed comics in the 2000s. Largely defined, like a lot of media, by living in a post-9/11 world. How do you tell superhero stories about superheroes when the real world seems to be absence of the ones we need? I think fiction needed to catch up on that. And then he kind of gives a dig to Fight Club that I thought was weird. But it's really interesting to say, you know, we need... and Tom Brevoort, too, makes a comment about returning to the world of the world outside your window. Mm-hmm. So really defining superheroes as real people, and real and relatable and stuff in the 2000s, which is interesting, I think. That we had, that they perceive it as having gotten so far away from that.
I feel like every era is just a reflection on the last era,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So in the 90s was just filled with a lot of art.
Yeah.
Not a lot of stories that really resonate with you. I mean, you know, you think of the 90s, you think of like Jim Lee's Wolverine or Cyclops, but I don't remember what that comic was about.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, a lot of those stories are fantastic and deeply important to people, but at the same time, like, it doesn't resonate with me like it would The Watchmen or something like that. Of course, this is superhero stories, so maybe it's a little bit different than thinking in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Something that resonated with me in this article was the social media aspect and then the diverse talent and diverse characters aspect.
And that's
I kind of think they go together.
The 2010s kind of phasing into the 2020s, right?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I went to college in 2002 and there really wasn't any social media when I went to college.
That's crazy. Yeah.
Facebook didn't exist yet until I was like midway through college.
Yeah, I mean, so we're separated by about 10 years, right? And so that totally defined my college and even high school experience. Mm-hmm. It also defined the way I interacted with comics. I mean, I really started... When did Comixology launch?
Gosh, later, I think.
2007. And when it started.
Really? Yeah.
But I was definitely reading comics on Comixology in 2011-ish, 2010-ish, which was born out of the fact that I had graduated high school. I'd gone to college. I started college in 2011. We're separated by about 10 years. And I had a lot of free time to engage with a hobby or something, right? And so I started reading comics online after kind of liking them as a kid on and off. So the access is certainly indisputable, and a lot of creators have comments about that.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's fascinating to me, like, seeing writers coming up now. One person that comes to mind is Leah Williams, mm-hmm. who has fully admitted that she's been part of that, like, social media culture, and now she's writing the stories. And I'm right. very fascinated to see how she evolves as a writer, because she's coming out of something no other writer can say they did, mm-hmm. right? And you could actually argue that a lot of comic creators, be it artists or writers, it didn't change a lot for a long time. It, obviously, there was more mature themes and stuff like that, but now we've got, like, infusion of technology.
Right.
When it comes to artists, too, like, there are one of the reasons why we can see we have so many amazing artists is because of the tablets they're using, right?
Oh, right, yeah. Or how easy it is to just post a work in progress to Twitter or something, you know?
Right, and get and be heard and be seen.
To workshop yeah. things in public, which is both good and bad, I think. Mm-hmm. Because you're surrounded by, if you want to be a good comics artist, you have to market yourself. You have to be plugged into social media. CB Cebulski actually has a tweet, or not a tweet, a comment here that says, in the 2010s, it's been amazing time for discovering new talent. Never before have we seen so many ready for prime time new creators writing and drawing comics, both independent and mainstream from around the globe, adding the diversity of new voices. Yeah, I bet you think so. To storytelling in both the print and digital mediums, which is really interesting mm-hmm. because he's basically saying you need to be a known quantity by the time you make mm-hmm. it to Marvel, right?
And part of the reason is because, and this is in the 2010 section, right?
Yeah.
Part of the reason of this isn't just because of the technology, but it's because all these crazy Spider-Man and X-Men movies that came out in the 2000s.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, oh, man, there's a lot to unpack here, right?
Yeah.
But yeah. To make my original point, which was that if you need to be an artist on Twitter or a comics artist, you have to follow every editor, every artist, every writer in the comics industry, or most of them. And then you have the shot of getting your art noticed when you publish it. But you're also surrounded by people that have, quote unquote, already made it. Mm-hmm. And that's a really toxic environment to work in. Sure. You don't have the same time and resources as the artists that are drawing X-Men for a living when you're right. starting out.
No, I mean, didn't I send you an article about how the average writer only makes $6,000 a
year? Right, yeah.
This is an industry where you have to have, like, one or two other jobs to yeah. be able to do
it. Or an incredible partner, you know.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And then the other big thing you alluded to was the end of the 2000s. Steve Orlando has a comment about this exactly. Says, with Morrison and quietly at the wheel, X-Men pushed forward the mutant concept in bold and innovative books, in bold and innovative ways. It was one of the first books to react to a film.
Right, right.
And that's how different that is now, like you were just alluding to.
Mm-hmm.
It's the, I think Tom Brevoort said that it is kind of the center of pop culture now. Comics are.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Everybody, it's cool to love comics.
Well, isn't that interesting?
When I grew up, you were like beat up if you like comics.
By guys named...
Back in 1917.
By guys named Corn Pop at the local
school. Corn Pop, yeah.
Do you think it is cool to like comics now?
Or like superheroes, one might say.
Those things are not the same, though.
Right, right.
Like
right.
Tom Brevoort is saying comics are the capstone or the foundation of all of our popular culture, which is true. The Marvel Universe
right, it's all
is
built
huge.
On it, yeah.
It's all built on that. But you don't see massive gains in the comics, the hard comics, singles, or trades industry.
No.
It's not like they're $1 billion up or anything. Like the Infinity Gauntlet trade did good last year, but I don't think it completely change the landscapes of comics publishing.
No.
So, and this, I tricked you into talking about this.
What? I want to talk
oh,
about
well,
it.
Here we go. You ready?
I don't know what
you
it
ready?
Is.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's why I think Bad Idea isn't selling comics to you, motherfucker.
Wait, why?
Because they're selling something else.
Oh.
They're selling movie rights and TV rights
right.
and video game deals and action figure deals and whatever the fuck else they can touch on, because comics are the premier gateway into other mediums now.
It's a gateway drug. It's like weed.
But they're not... to a certain extent, like, if you get into pro wrestling, mm-hmm. you gotta watch AEW or WWE. Those are the televised brands, right?
Right.
You can go to every Marvel movie and not ever pick up a comic.
Right, yeah, they're supposed totally to be consumed without comics.
Right, exactly.
Right. And I think based on something you said earlier, which is the sales aren't necessarily, like, skyrocketing, there is only a certain number of human beings that want to read comics right now.
Right, right.
And something that's said in this article as well is everybody is trying to figure out how to sell comics based on the movies, because the movies are doing so well. Why aren't the comics doing better? And no one really has figured it out yet.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I think it's an audience problem. There's just a certain amount of human beings that want to consume stories in this way.
Right. Yeah. I think that the perfect example of that is that Comixology isn't ubiquitous. That, like, mm-hmm. Marvel and DC and Dark Horse all have their own apps still. Even though Comixology is owned by Amazon. Yeah. Like, it's so strange that no one has figured out the digital space yet, because obviously that's where readers are.
I wonder, you know, we need to do some research on the evolution of the television set. Because there had to have been a long period where it was like people would, like, not, you know, they wouldn't. I mean, there was only one TV, right? And there was only one way to get the television, which was through the airwaves.
Only one TV in your whole town.
In the whole town.
It had to be outside to get the airwaves.
But there was only, like, two channels. Right. It took a long time.
I mean, well, when you think about, like, the Challenger shuttle tragedy, right? There were studies after that that said, like, 85% of Americans with a TV saw it happen, because it was ubiquitous. Even at the time of Challenger, let alone stuff before that. Mm-hmm. And it's crazy that comics don't feel that way. It's cool.
Comics
cool.
are to microwaves as TV is to Marvel movies. Ergo, not everyone owns a microwave. Not everyone likes to use a microwave, but there is an audience that does.
Okay, sure. I'll take your point. Yeah.
And then within that audience, there are people who need the popcorn button.
Yep.
And those people are Squirrel Girl fans.
And then, you know, the last big point. It's interesting, like, a lot of people in the article, and it's a really fantastic article. Again, Susanna's an amazing journalist and editor. So much of it is clearly about how digital stuff has changed the industry, but mm-hmm. not necessarily the delivery, like we've been alluding to. That's strange. And then there's this thing tacked on to the end that is like, oh yeah, also YA graphic novels are going to take over and be all comics for forever, which is true.
I mean, I feel like this was added, like, last second, because sales just keep showing this is the area to develop.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jean Luen Yang, that's artist on American Born Chinese, Superman, Avatar, The Last Airbender, and then also Scott McCloud, writer and artist on Understanding Comics, Reinventing Comics, and Making Comics, two people that are very plugged into the industry, saying, you know, Raina, I can't always get her name wrong, Telgemeier, with Smile, mm-hmm. completely changed and built an entirely new avenue for comics delivery and storytelling, which is really
my
cool.
My second favorite comic of the week is a YA
right,
book.
Right, right. Some of the favorite comics I read last year were DC's YA books. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a fascinating article. I don't know if it says anything definitive, but it's cool to read all these opinions and sort of make your own opinion.
Yeah, and which we did a great job of. I heard
Thank
your
you.
Microwave analogy. It was good.
Did you feel it, though? Hold on. Close your eyes. Beep. 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 Wait, that's the wrong thing. That's not a microwave.
That's funny.
All right, now put a fork inside. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, it's very cool. I recommend people check it out.
You know, we're trying to do the same thing that this Polygon article did every week You just have to listen to it all fast forward.
Decades worth of information.
We've got a year plus going. In our next segment, Top Books of Last Week, we talk about our two favorite comics out last week. And to start this segment, we always talk about comicbookroundup.com's top critic and fan pick. And this week it's easy. Daredevil number 19 gets a 9.6 from critics and a 9.3 from fans.
Yes. 10 out of 10 review on AIPTcomics.com from Christopher Franey, who says, "This is a fantastic issue, a story of the people rising up as heroes and standing against evil. Matt Murdock begins his journey back to Daredevil, and the pieces that have been introduced since issue number one are coming together," which I'm really excited about. I like this book a lot. And then Grifter, with a 10 out of 10 review on fan reviews, says, "Epic."
Okay, I am certain for us that you are trying to find the shortest ones.
I'll read you the top one.
Oh, please don't.
Alan Quinone.
Oh, I don't want to know.
Amazing.
It's like five paragraphs.
Nothing else to say about it. A damn perfect issue.
Very nice.
I'm not going to read one of these because it is just a quote from the book. But yeah, okay. Most fans don't leave reviews. I recommend people try it out. I really like reviewing stuff on like Letterboxd and GG app for reviewing and tracking video games, Goodreads, and then obviously we write or speak out kind of longer form comics reviews. But I think it really is an interesting insight into what you like and don't like in mediums. And it's something that I only got plugged into once I started doing it, externalizing things that you like. It's a really interesting process, and I would recommend folks on comicbookroundup.com do that.
Yeah, just by reviewing, you kind of discover things, isn't
it? You learn. It's an intense learning process, I think.
Tell us about your second favorite intense learning process.
My second favorite book of last week, this week, I guess, whatever. Spider-Man Noir, number one, written by Margaret Stahl with art by Juan Ferreira. I haven't gotten to talk about a Spider-Man book in a while, huh?
Yeah, I was starting to think you just fell off the wagon.
You thought I gave up on it. Not super big on Spider-Man Noir. In general, it's fine. It's an interesting idea.
Oh my God, I sent you the trade, yes, remember?
Yeah.
That's crazy. I forgot about
that. It's fine. I like the Nick Cage adaptation more than anything else, I think, in the space. And it's also...
He's offbeat and fun.
It's also weird that they're kind of like doubling down on this. Like, we both liked Grim Noir last week.
I don't know
what this reintroduction or new interest in the noir stuff at Marvel is, but hey... Juan Ferreira gets it.
Mm-hmm.
This book is a little exposition heavy. It's a little locked up in the, like, if you don't like books that are like, "Ye old, thou doest," you know, that kind of stuff. It's that, but noir gangster lingo. But man, Juan Ferreira, there's so much kinetic energy to the way he draws Peter Parker slinging through this muted, gray, gross, rainy, gritty Manhattan. I love, there's this one page early on where he does like a flip over a Bugsy type car, and you get the outlines of him in process and stuff like that. The design of the book is amazing. Again, a lot of it is a black and white, but there's these really awesome spurts of color. So like the muzzle flare from his gun is bright yellow, or these like streaking red lights atop the police cars. The lettering is also really amazing. And then you have like his spider senses, like he's in all black and white, muted gray, the rain's coming down on him. And then you've got this bright red spider like circle around his face and stuff. It's just this really, really awesome place-bound storytelling. I think certain artists do a really good job with the constraints of a genre or with the constraints of a certain script, and Juan takes that idea and just runs with it here. It is an amazing looking book.
It sure is. It's funny, Juan goes to Marvel at the same time as pretty much at the same time as Benjamin Percy comes to Marvel, and they work together on a Green Arrow. I ended up reviewing a lot of those, and I what I particularly like about Juan is his ability to draw double page layouts. He stretches the page really cool, and he does it, I think, at least once in Spider-Man Noir,
I think
Noir,
there are two. Yeah, there's one towards the beginning and one towards the end. I really like that all of his characters, I think I spoke about this last week with Bang too. He trusts you to figure out how the character got there or what happened in between panels, right? Like, it isn't a panel of him walking from panel to panel to panel or anything like that. There's dramatic cuts to, or at least on this, towards the end, they're standing on a dock, and it's like a dramatic cut from an airplane to Peter and a woman speaking, and then like to some documents on a table on top of a map and stuff. And that puts a certain amount of trust in the reader to piece things together. And I really like that.
Yeah, it's really cool. I had an Indiana Jones vibe from the book,
yes,
too.
Yes, I think that's fair.
Especially with the plane at the last page. Mm-hmm. With the red dots, the dashes. I'm psyched that you liked that, dude.
I did like it, yeah.
Now, if we can just get a Spider-Man Noir cartoon, that'd be great. Did you read it in Nicolas Cage's
voice? Yeah. Well, no, I read it in more of like a, yeah, see? I'm Peter Parker, solving crimes.
See? I don't know if they say see
the
a lot.
The lobster got got in a cage. The cat got scratched on a page.
Oh my God, I should be snapping my fingers
Green
right now.
Green eggs and ham with Uncle.
Are you wearing a beret?
Sam.
Oh God, make it stop. In my second favorite book, I talk about Aster and the Accidental Magic, number one. Do you like how I
like
queued
that
up?
Yeah, see?
It was written by Tom Pico with art by Karen Sack. Actually, one of our writers at AIPT got to interview the creators, Nicole... Shoot, I forgot her last name all of a sudden.
Herview.
Herview? Is that how you say it?
I don't know.
Yeah. Nicole Herview got to interview the creators. I recommend checking that out. After I reviewed the book, I read her interview, and there's some interesting things she got out of them that kind of inform the book. This is my second review of a Random House graphic. Mm-hmm. Graphic novel. It's like 240 pages or so. It's pretty thick. You basically get two stories split down the middle in one. And what's fascinating to me about this read was it is a little slow to start. That was one of my negatives in my review on AIPTcomics.com, but it builds on itself. So once you get to the second story, things in the first story mattered. And sometimes, especially with the first Random House graphic book that I read and reviewed, it was episodic in the same way, but the stories didn't build so much. Whereas in this, like Aster, things that Aster does in the first story end up mattering in the second story, which made me even more excited because they're going to be making another one or two of these books. I think it's two more because they said they had two more seasons, I think. Anyway, it's just filled with magic. could you guess that from the title? But this girl named Aster lives out in the mountains. She's super bored. Her brother goes to college. She's now all alone. Her dad's like annoyed by her being in the house. And he's like, go outside and play. And that, of course, ends up working out in her favor if, you know, you want to go on adventures, which she does. And it's just really imaginative. It's really colorful. The creators actually in the interview Nicole did, they actually mentioned that they were inspired by cartoons like Gravity Falls and stuff like that.
Neat.
I had no idea that was the case, but when I was reading, I think I said in my review too, like, they need to turn this into a cartoon. Mm-hmm. It just has a great, like, you know, imaginative feel that's fun. It's obviously catered to a younger audience. It is a YA book. I didn't, as an adult reading it, I appreciate what it's doing for younger kids. Runaway Princess was more just like crazy. There's some bizarre stuff in there. So for me as an adult, that I like that a little bit more. But with this, I think adults can like it too because of the way it kind of pays off a lot of things by the end of the book. So you're not just reading like a fun, light story that ends up not mattering. It all kind of builds to something.
Right.
Well, that was just my second favorite. We have to get to the number ones now. Yeah. This is where we're really going to throw down.
Yeah.
What is your number one book of last week?
My number one book of last week is King of Nowhere, number one. This is written by W. Maxwell Prince with art by Tyler Jenkins. This is from Boom. It's a number one from Boom. It's an amazing book. It's like a kinder, more philosophical Hunter S. Thompson meets Big Fish take on a world and character development.
Wow.
There's a main character whose name I actually can't remember right now. I don't know if they say. Who wakes up in a world that kind of follows logic similar to like the Sandman universe or the Dreaming, where things are just happening to him. And then he's kind of narrating over the top of it like, well, you didn't wake up in a ditch. You didn't wake up in your own bed. You didn't wake up in someone else's bed. So this is a new thing. Right. Mm-hmm. And then he's kind of trying to like piece out like, okay, am I on LSD? Am I laying on the ground dying somewhere? Like, what's going on? As he steps into this watercolor-esque world and meets a small car driven by a deer man. Or makes friends with a fish at a bar who says he's about to get beat up by a man with many arms. Who he convinces that that can't possibly happen because he's in his dream. And then a man with many arms comes into the door and punches them both in the face. And then this kind of circuitous logic that is... he ends up like indebted to the police force and fighting giant iguanas with a gun they've given him and stuff. And like, it sounds like nonsense and it reads like nonsense a little bit, but is grounded by one amazing art and amazing colors. A kind of Ralph Steadman-esque take on like what Tyler Crook does in Harrow County. And then two, by this again, really fascinating narration that I think, W. Maxwell Prince worked really, really hard on to balance with the visuals and with the dialogue that grounds it in a really interesting way, that suggests this is a man down on his luck who's really struggling, who is externalizing his problems, certainly, who's acting out through drugs and drinking and stuff like that, and who is maybe so delusional that all of this stuff is made up. But also maybe not.
Yeah, it sort of leans that way, doesn't it?
Right. And so this, especially at the very end of the book, when the focus shifts completely away from him and two characters have their own conversation in an epilogue, it's playing with reader expectations very, very interestingly, touching on things like depression, anxiety, drug abuse, things that don't sound fun but are actually really fun in a way in this book. And I'm really, really interested to see kind of both the internal and external struggles that this character goes through in this world. I was brought into it immediately.
Yeah, the art by Jenkins is amazing. Yeah. Really pulls you in. I got to interview Maxwell Prince. It actually went up this week, I think, the interview. And in it, he was talking about how it's a scumbag story.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I said, you know, it's kind of a Hunter S. Thompson story. Fear and loathing in Narnia. And so if that appeals to you, I think he's nailed that perfectly.
I have a feeling it's going to be adapted to a film or something eventually.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can already tell.
Get this over to Bad Idea.
Yeah, they're going to be able to pull it off real well.
It's going
to
go off like Cracker Jacks, man. IP is everything.
It really is.
It is. That's hard to dispute, but I'm being snarky. I'm sorry.
Speaking of new IP, my number one book of the week is Strange Academy number one by Scotty Young and Humberto Ramos.
I like this too. This was neat.
Yeah, you know, in all honesty, I was totally skeptical that this would be good.
Yeah.
or good for someone my age and whatever. Because I was a little worried it might be like for little kids or something, but I shouldn't have ever thought that because it's a Marvel comic and they're pretty much for everybody across the board. So I think this book was just really well plotted and paced and written. I actually said this in my review at aptcomics.com. Like, I feel like when I was reading it, I kept thinking like Scotty Young wrote this script like a year ago and was probably tinkering with it until, you know, he had to give it to Ramos because I don't know. It's just, it pulls together all these young characters, gives us little touches on their character. So they have like a personality really quickly. And then on top of that, we meet this main character. We get to see, you know, mainstay magic characters from Marvel Comics. Mm-hmm. There is like a battle going on at the end, a great cliffhanger that leaves us wanting more involving Doctor Strange. And then also the kids, they're all different in their ways of having magic. Either it's like, I think one kid had, it's like his clothes were magic or his body was. It's really weird. And then there's a kid with like a flaming head and there's some, I think he was from like Purgatory or something. There's a character who's magic wielding from Asgard. It's just, it's a really good mix of a lot of things coming together. And Humberto Ramos, I think, was like born to draw teenage looking characters. So he's like the perfect fit for this book. I would venture to say this might be like a new kind of X-Men.
Yeah. Absolutely.
If they can pull this off and pull it off for, say, 100 issues, I wouldn't be surprised if not our generation, because, you know, we're so steeped in X-Men and that's our X-Men, but a younger generation could pick this up and, like, 30 years from now, I wouldn't be surprised if it was, like, as big as X-Men.
I think Scotty is very, very good at that. I think I alluded to that last week when we talked about this. That's how I feel about Middle West, too. Like, he just gets world building and narrative design and, like, relatable, likable characters and character design, you know, coupled with Ramos in a way that feels very memorable and distinct. I did think that this issue missed a little bit of, like, narrative thrust. I was a little like, okay, so why do I need to tune in next week? But the world is so endearing that I wanted to anyway.
Yeah, my main complaint was the main character that we meet in the very first few pages. I didn't get to know her well enough to really want to join her on her... I just want to see more of the all world. These characters. Yeah. I don't... And they were trying to do, like, she's the main character, but not really kind of thing.
Yeah, I think you need someone to drive it. So we'll see if that happens.
But yeah, if they just had Batman in it.
This is big Academy X vibes. You're right.
So. Yeah, I think I'm very excited to see the sales numbers on this, too. Marvel's putting a lot behind this
book. Does well.
Scotty does well.
Scotty does well, see? He takes two stories, he splits them down the middle. You get.
Oh, my God. Forrest has been Spider-Man noired. Somebody get him medicine. Just a, not black coffee, though. It has to be lots of cream, because they drink black coffee on those, I think.
I drink black coffee.
In our next segment. Me too. Top books for next week. We drink hot coffee black
with our
in our
Wendy's
top books for
breakfast.
Next week. I can't wait to eat those burritos or whatever they
Wendy's
are.
Wendy's breakfast is my next fest, see?
This is where we talk about our most anticipated book out next week. Can I go first?
I want you to go first.
My most anticipated book is Decorum?
Yeah.
Not with a question mark. Decorum number one by Jonathan Hickman and Mike Huddleston. This is an interesting read. I haven't been able to read it yet, but I've gotten to flip through it because I'm a press guy and I'm lucky. But wow, it is an eclectic bunch of pages of art. Like, the art is just fantastic. You scroll through it and you're like, wow, like, Huddleston's amazing. How many different artists live inside his head? This book also contains, like, data pages and stuff. So if you're really digging Dawn of X, Hawks and Pox, you're going to be like, wow, this is kind of more of that, but in a different way, of course. Right. Obviously, it's sci-fi, and we already know Hickman can pull off those really big sci-fi ideas, but also little sci-fi ideas. He's also really good at pulling together a lot of ideas so that it makes it sort of like a puzzle, right? You're like kind of like disassembling it and then reassembling it and figuring these things out, which if, when we get to the off-topic top shelf, I'll be talking a little bit about that as well in with my pick. But yeah, I'm really pumped for this. I don't think Image has had a book feel this way in a while. They do have the Kirkman Sam Nee book coming out soon. I think that might be next week even. Or no, 2 weeks from now? I don't know. Anyway, just looks really inventive and really cool, hard sci-fi.
Yeah, I'm very excited for it. I like when Hickman gets to take a world and run with it. You know, I like his attempt at reinventing the X-Men. I think his it's succeeding way better than I ever imagined, and I think he has a lot of people helping him pull that off. But when he gets to do his own little independent thing, it's also very cool. I mean, East of West is awesome. So
it's also cool to know it's probably going to be a long series. Most of his Image series have been quite long. So what is your most anticipated book out
my
next
most
week?
Anticipated book out next week is Star Wars Bounty Hunters number one, written by Ethan Sachs with art by Paolo Villanelli. Bounty Hunters are the best part of the Star Wars universe.
Get out. What about Jedi?
End statement. And that's why I'm excited for this book. That's it. That's I mean, I yeah, say. Seriously.
Boba Fett's in it. That's all that IG-88 matters, right?
IG-88 looks like he's in it, so all right.
Actually, the right pronunciation is Boba Fett. Sorry. Okay,
Baba
next segment. Judging
Fett.
By the cover,
Boba Fett
Jr.
Boba Fett Jr.
Seriously, I don't know why George Lucas didn't pull that off with the prequels. What is your favorite cover art out next
My
week?
Favorite cover art next week is the Marcos Martin God Loves Man Kills cover for New Mutants number 9. I love Marcos Martin. I love his stylized approach. His very stark, minimalistic take on everything. Incredible eye for design. This one is no different. We've got a side profile of a man's face and kind of an inverted cross structure. Incredible slant to it. You've got Tom Moeller's great New Mutants red and yellow font over the bottom of it. And then you've got like really stylized takes on Wolverine and Nightcrawler and Colossus and Storm and stuff in the foreground as well as kind of in the background in Storm's case. It's got this really interesting, like, if you start at Storm's head, the image gets like heavier and heavier and heavier until the bottom where it's a solid color. Or you can do the inverse, and if you read New Mutants at the top, it gets lighter and lighter and lighter as you ascend up the cover. So I love stuff that plays around with that. It's very, very interesting. I don't know if he designed it specifically for New Mutants or if he just did a series of God Loves Man Kills, like, throwback covers, but really, really good either way.
Yeah, it looks real pretty. If you go to AIPTComics.com and go to this post, you can actually see
you
the
should
cover.
Be able to see them on your podcast feed as well now.
Yeah. That's true.
They're going to be tiny. Anyway.
Not the full
it's
image.
As small as a Boba Fett Jr.
Do you think we're Boba Fett rich? Because we're not. My favorite cover art comes from Decorum Number 1, Woohoo, by Mike Huddleston. Mine's cheating because it's actually the front and back of the book. It's all one giant, like, double page. I would call it a layout. What's really cool is it's kind of like a collage of things going on, but there are all these really sci-fi-y things going on, right? There's like these spaceship boats flying around. There's a woman in this really cool black, like, looking like leather costume. With a very domineering look to her. There's like a gangster dude with like striped suit but in front of some strange Guggenheim looking, I'm going to assume it's a club. There's like a little cute little robot guy who looks like he's a cross between a shark and I don't know, lion cat. And then we've got just a lot going on here. But I'm going to tell you something. Fifth Element is one of my favorite sci-fi films. I mean, I saw it at the right age. I was like 12. But there's like a huge swath of like aliens and visual design in that, and this cover is giving me that vibe. We've got a lot going on and I want to piece it all together. I want to jump into that cover and maybe not die.
Okay. That's my favorite. I like cover that. I like that caveat. Week.
Thanks. So that's it for Judging by the Cover Junior. In our last segment, it is always our last segment. It's what are we eating at Wendy's?
I'm excited for the hollandaise sauce on spicy nugs.
It's off topic, top shelf.
I was
silly.
Fucking ready with that. Don't even deny.
Oh, you really were. Yeah. You really were. It's almost like we
it's,
set it up.
It's almost like I've been
beforehand.
Thinking about that this entire time.
Are you hungry?
Yeah. Yes. Always.
So my off topic, top shelf is Devs, which just started on FX. You can also get it on Hulu. It's a new science fiction show by Alex Garland. You might know him from, what is your favorite movie?
Annihilation.
Annihilation.
Adaption continuation of Jeff Vandermeer's novel.
Garland's done also Ex Machina, a bunch of movies you've probably seen. They're all really interesting
heady.
Sci-fi.
Yeah.
Yes, they make you think. And this show makes you think. I was a huge Lost fan. I'm not comparing this to Lost, but I'm comparing the enjoyment and discovery and trying to figure things out. And from the minute go, you're kind of doing that with this show. I don't want to spoil anything. It's got a really good cast, a diverse cast too, and some high production values. Nick Offerman's in it. He's probably the biggest, I would say, star so far that shows up. Only one episode has aired, but it's dealing with, I want to say, like, computer programming, but there's a deeper, probably insidious thing going on.
Human programming.
Maybe. I think it's time travel, but that's just me. Imagine if I nailed it in one, like, everybody just spoiled it. Anyway, I'm really hoping there's answers to this. I know that Garland is pretty good at
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I think, you know, the Annihilation film is more coherent than the book. I prefer the book, but Ex Machina has a ton of answers. So,
for sure. I don't think it's the show that's going to frustrate you like some sci-fi
and
shows.
And it's a discrete 8-episode miniseries, right? On Hulu?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it seems like it was structured to have... There's no reason to make a thrust for a second season or whatever, right?
Yeah, for all we know, yeah. And actually, one of our writers at AIPT, Alex Curtis, he went to the New York Comic Con debut of the show. And I'd recommend just checking out that article. There's some interesting tidbits from Alex Garland, not Alex Curtis.
I was going to ask if you've ever seen them in the same place. Maybe the tidbit seems so natural because...
It seems like he's taking the pictures in this article, so I'm going to say no.
Interesting.
Anyway, it's fascinating because Garland talks about how the two-hour film structure is limiting, and the show gives him more space to kind of explore his ideas, and that's really exciting.
Yeah.
Well, that's it for the show, guys.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you
for
so much for listening.
I am sorry I complained a lot this week. Maybe next week will be better in the comics industry. It's always good in comics. But very sincere thanks to our fans and to our listeners. A couple of folks have been reaching out to us on Twitter. That's very, very cool.
Hell yeah.
They can find you at no socialize on Twitter and me at @FORREST_TXT on Twitter. So please feel free to reach out. It's a lot of fun. Or check out Empire State of Mind next Tuesday, or the call for questions the Wednesday after.
For sure. And we're always here Sunday mornings to fill you in on the week.
And Wendy's breakfast.
Maybe that could just be this one episode.
I don't know. All right. Bye, y'all.
Bye.